Is there life after failure? Is there life after failure? Thomas Edison is famous for saying, apparently in reference to the light bulb, "I've not failed, I've just found 10,000 ways that won't work." Thankfully, though, the Christian does not need to look at the Christian life with that kind of spirit. Because really behind that kind of statement, and we appreciate that effort, we benefit from Edison's labors and his tenacity. But in God's kingdom, repentant failures aren't left alone. So we don't have to say, well, I'm going to rephrase this and use a different term or use the same term but put my own meaning to it. Within God's kingdom, not only does he use people who have failed and failed egregiously, but he actually works those failures into the thread of his plan in such a way that shows even more the amazing grace, love, wisdom, and power that are his. God graciously works, I think we'll see in 2 Samuel 15. God graciously works through David, even as he continues to bring consequences to David's family. I want you to hear both sides of that. God graciously works through David, even as he continues to bring consequences to David and his family for David's sin. What does this work of God look like? What does this gracious work of God look like in 2 Samuel 15? Well, there's two primary parts to God's work in this chapter. And right off the bat, let's see that God continues to bring consequences to David's family through Absalom's evil. This is part of God showing grace. This is part of his work. To reveal himself, he continues to bring consequences to David's family through evil. And we've seen this. If you've been tracking through our series, this should not be a new revelation to you. We have seen David's family suffering from his sin. We have seen evil rising up among them. That continues. And that continues specifically in this chapter through Absalom himself. He is undermining the nation's trust in David. From the viewpoint of the narrator, there's no question of that. From David's viewpoint, whether through David's purposeful turning away or just through him being deceived by his son, from David's view, this is not out in the open yet. From the perspective of the narrator, we can see these things coming together. He's undermining the nation's trust in King David. And he tricks the people. First six verses of the chapter, this is all a sham. You might look at verse 1 and say, how did David miss it? Isn't he kind of playing king here? But really, this is not terribly far from what a prince of that day might do. Princes like to think that they have some authority and they have some sway. By taking 50 men on to run before him, by getting really the power weapon of the day, the chariot, now Absalom could call himself a captain. He's commanding men. And we might look at that and see arrogance, and we might not be wrong. But this is something that a prince of the day, especially a prince in Absalom's position, could do. But then as the text goes on, his trickery continues. He's very strategic. He arises early in the morning to go to the gate, which is where things happened and where you could have influence. And as he would be standing there, he would just start talking to people. He was a very personable man when he wanted to be. He would strike up conversations and people would be coming from all over the nation. Oh, where are you from? Somewhere in the conversation, people would look to show him honor. And Absalom was not that. He was a man of the people. And so instead of being respected in some formal way. No, come here, let me give you, in our terms, I want to shake your hand. In their terms, give him a kiss. Absalom is very persuasive. But I want us to see, not just in all of what he's doing, let's also see what he's saying in verse 4. Oh, that I were a judge in the land, that every man with a dispute or cause might come to me, and I would give him justice. It is so easy, is it not, from a position that does not bear responsibility to speak of what you would do if you were in that position of responsibility. Even today, the call, the one-word change is still powerful. As David bears the weight of administration and responsibility, here's his son dreaming of a time and speaking of a time when he gets to actually bring justice. But even in that statement, one word in particular, I think, should scream out at us. Here is Absalom, the man who had his servants murder his half-brother. Here's Absalom, the man who had his servants go and burn down the field of Joab. Here's Absalom saying, I wish that I could actually bring justice to the land. Isn't it sad that so many speak of justice when they know nothing of what justice means? If Absalom had been shown justice, would he even be alive at this moment? So we can see that from our perspective. But again, he's very persuasive. He has a way about him. And he is slowly bringing the people over to his side. These words are empty. And time will show that. But at the moment, people cannot discern that. And so at the end, you get down to verse 6, and he's doing this to all of Israel. It's not just Judah, it's not just those nearby, who came to the king for judgment. And as he's doing this, he steals the hearts of the men of Israel. That language there really means he tricked them. This is used of Jacob tricking Laban in Genesis 31. In fact, even if we're careful and we look at what he's saying, there is no man designated by the king to hear you, just to show more of the emptiness, you just turn back one chapter. And what do you see in chapter 14? You see David talking to what? To whom? To a woman from Tekoa. About a matter that she is seeking protection, or she's seeking protection for her son, and she's seeking the king. In other words, you don't have to go far back in the story of 2 Samuel to see that David, at least at that time, was still seeing people. The words of Absalom are empty, they're lies. And really, before we go on past verse 6, let's just stop long enough to recognize that evil, if it is left unchecked, if evil is not properly not properly responded to, not corrected, it moves further and further towards death. It moves further and further towards destruction. It hurts more and more people. There is something here that Absalom is able to pick at. David has not been perfect in all of his justice. The throne has not been right in all that it has done. And Absalom is a case in point. Evil uncorrected moves further towards death, towards catastrophe, towards worse consequences. Is that something that you need to consider for your own life? For your own home, in the realm of your responsibilities? What obvious things are you choosing to ignore or to accept? And I just want to remind you from the teaching, here's a perfect story to look at and be reminded of the truth that if you ignore your responsibilities, especially clear evil, where you have responsibility to respond to it, if you ignore that, It does not get better on its own. Well, this trajectory is going to keep going towards rebellion. Verse 7, at the end of 4 years, Absalom says, "Please let me go and pay my vow that I vowed to the Lord in Hebron." Even in that statement in verse 7, you might have a note in your Bible. Is it 4? Is it 40 years? There are some parts of the Old Testament that just because of transmission, human error is bound to happen over time. And there's less certainty on some things like this term 4. It's hard to say that it's 40 years because if Absalom is 40 years old, then the king reigned longer than 40 years. He was born during David's reign in Hebron, at the beginning of David's reign. David reigns for 40 years, so if Absalom is born during David's reign, he doesn't turn 40 with his father still on the throne. I mean, if we're just looking at how time plays out there, it's not likely. What does 4 years then refer to? Is this 4 years since he had Amnon murdered? Is it 4 years since he returned to Jerusalem? Whatever it is, David's request is not so out of order, or Absalom's request is not so out of order that David withholds giving his blessing. To some extent, this request makes sense to David. And so David allows him to go and complete, to pay his vow to the Lord in Hebron. But this is all, again, a sham. In the end, the king says to him, "Go in peace." He goes, but even as he goes, he's, verse 10, sending secret messengers. The plot continues. He brings with him 200 men from Jerusalem, but those men don't realize what Absalom is doing. They are just pawns in all of this. They're innocent. And somewhere as this is happening then, also this message goes to Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor. Now, that in particular adds depth and meaning to what Absalom is doing. We've seen in the past when Bathsheba came up, she was a well-connected lady in the city. Bathsheba was the daughter of one of David's mighty men. She was the wife of one of David's mighty men, and she was the granddaughter of Ahithophel. Bathsheba continues to be the wife of David. But who knows what David's sin in all of that contributed to with Ahithophel. At the end of the day, Ahithophel is one of David's closely trusted administrative men. And here he sides with Absalom. At the end of verses 1 to 12, 1 to 13, if we look back and see all that Absalom is doing, he is lying, he is planting unrest, he is tricking people, he is pretending to worship, and he is deceiving. I say pretending to worship because how can you claim in sincerity to worship God as you supplant his king? It's not possible. At least that worship is not going to be accepted by God. I look at that and I say he's just using worship as a cover. Look at the 200 men that he invites to go with him. He's just using those men. Be careful when you decide that others must sacrifice for you while you don't. He's calling these men to come out and serve with him. He's sending men out as messengers. He's gathering Ahithophel to his service. But all of this is for his own sake so that he can step up to the throne. Be careful when you put others in danger while protecting yourself, protecting your plans. And even more than that, beware when worship is not an end, but a means. And by that, I'm trying to communicate, beware when you are using worship for your own benefit instead of offering worship for the benefit, for the praise, for the glory, for the admiration of God. When we start using worship for our own means, it is no longer worship that is acceptable to God. If you are here as a sham, if you're here just to make yourself look good in some way, to twist things to your own benefit, to make others think that you actually care, your heart will be revealed at some point. God does not accept that kind of worship. God continues to bring consequences to David's family, even through somebody like Absalom. And now Absalom's evil threatens in verses 13 through 17, or 14 through 17. Now Absalom's evil is blossoming so much that it's starting to threaten the lives of David and those close to David. I've pointed back repeatedly to 2 Samuel 12, 10 to 12, where God says to David that he will rise up within David's family, evil, as part of the consequences of David's sin. And we find that term evil once again in our passage, chapter 15. As David is telling his followers to flee Jerusalem, he says to them in verse 14, go quickly, lest he overtake us quickly and bring down ruin on us. Or more literally, bring down evil. That term keeps coming up just to remind the reader that this is part of what God does to bring consequences on David and his family. David runs. You know, as David is leaving, maybe there's some questions. Why not take a stand against Absalom? Why give up the city so quickly? I think if you keep reading in 2 Samuel, one thing that you'll see is that time is on David's side. The advice that Ahithophel will give to Absalom is, you need to put David down quickly. Do not give him time. Absalom foolishly does not follow that advice, and as a result, he is killed and the rebellion is put down. So one answer I would say to that is, it seems that time is on David's side. Does he know that completely? David probably knows that there are others who will support and care for him. He doesn't know how this will end. You can see that in his words about the Ark of the Covenant. But David is wise enough by this time to know that perhaps he needs to choose when to have that battle. He is surprised, and so he chooses to fight another day. There's another part of that section, though, that is perturbing, confusing, or just plain seems wrong. Verse 16, the king goes and all his household, but he leaves 10 of his concubines there to keep the house. They're like partial. Not quite the full standing of the wife of a king, but still bound to him. Why would he do that? Especially when you see what Absalom does. And I don't have a complete answer to that. I'll just propose one idea for you to think about. Concubines could end up in that situation where they are now in the harem of a king as a political act, where one group of people wants to have peace or some kind of trade treaty with another group of people, and how do they bring that treaty about? Well, they do something like this. The king's daughter goes off to be joined to this other king and this king's daughter, and so there's a swapping of daughters. It's possible, and again, I can't prove this, just trying to make sense of it, it's possible that these 10 were left in order to keep peace between Israel and some other people groups. So that he leaves them in the harem of the next king. Did he expect Absalom to do what he did? No, I certainly don't think so. That still doesn't sound right. And I get it. David shouldn't have 10 concubines. He should have one wife. That makes his situation a lot more simple. But this world is complicated. We bring further complications to it. And so he leaves 10 there to keep the house. It could be, again, that part of that keeping of the house is keeping the house in good standing with other powerful houses in the world at the time. Now, if power is everything, the story could stop here after verse 17 and resume in chapter 16, verse 15. Now, Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, came to Jerusalem, and Ahithophel with him. If power was everything, you could skip all the conversations that David has with others between 15:17 and 16:15. Power is not everything. And what you have between those two verses now is finally, we see the shepherd of Israel again. Finally, we see this man showing faith again and experiencing the grace of God as he seeks to shepherd those around him. See, God continues to bring consequences to David's family, and he's doing that through Absalom. We see that. But God sovereignly cares for David still as David leads those with him. And I want you to see that now in the rest of the chapter. He's sovereignly caring for David as David leads those with him. And we hold both of those to be true. David is suffering consequences as God sovereignly brings those to David and his family. And David is experiencing the grace of God as he suffers those consequences. As David flees, he talks. Again, here's an experienced king, and he has people around him. Notice the type of people that he's interacting with here, and see the kindness of God towards David in those people. You could go to Psalm 3. There's a prescript there that recognizes that psalm to be during this season of David's life. I want you to see in these conversations, we're only going to continue the ones that happened through chapter 15, but there's more that happened in chapter 16. As we look at some of these conversations then that he has, see the grace of God towards David and see God working through David to shepherd the people of Israel still. The first conversation that comes up, he had a conversation with his people generally in 13 through 17. But now he speaks specifically to Ittai in verses 18 to 23. He talks with Ittai before crossing the brook Kidron. Notice, as he's talking with Ittai, the son of David betrays him, but here is this Philistine who shows kindness to David, loyalty to David. Notice the comparison, even just with that. You have the Cherethites and the Pelethites, who are David's bodyguard. But you also have the 600 Gittites who have joined with David recently. We find that it's a recent thing because he says, look, you came only yesterday. Shall I today make you wander about with us? I don't know where I'm going. Why should you come along? And that really leads into an amazing conversation. Because here, David then blesses this Philistine. The Gittites are likely from Philistia, from Gath. And he says to this foreigner, go and stay with the king. Don't put yourself any more at risk, basically. Go back and take your brothers with you. And may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you. It's wonderful to see that term in David's mouth once again. Remember before his sin with Bathsheba and before he arranged the murder of Uriah, remember this was a man who sought to show kindness to the family of Saul. This was a man who sought to show kindness to another king's family. And here now he is blessing Once again, may the Lord show steadfast love, that show the kindness of God. May you experience that. May you experience the faithfulness of God. And Ittai answers to him, you don't get to be a commander of 600 men without some backbone to you. Well, as Yahweh lives, as the Lord lives, and as my Lord the King lives, there's a double promise. Wherever my Lord the King, and that's a very purposeful use of the term, he still sees David as the king. Wherever my Lord the King shall be, if it brings death or life, we would rather put it if it brings life or death, but if it brings death or life, there also will your servant be. And so David says, okay, so be it. Go then, pass on. Oh, to be an Ittai. Do you know any others like Ittai in the Bible? In fact, in the line of David, just a few generations back, was a woman named Ruth, who said at one point, Ruth 1:16 and following, said to a bitter mother-in-law, do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you, for where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts me from you. Since we're using the name Ittai, we might as well speak of Onesiphorus. Just names that don't exactly roll off the tongue, but these people are present in the Bible. In 2 Timothy 1:16 to 18, Paul says, may the Lord grant mercy to the household of Onesiphorus, for he often refreshed me and was not ashamed of my chains. But when he arrived in Rome, he searched for me earnestly and found me. May the Lord grant him to find mercy from the Lord on that day. And you well know all the service he rendered at Ephesus. You see, if it's the case of walking beside a mother-in-law as you return to the land destitute, or if it's the case of searching out for the prisoner, Paul, if it's the case of staying with a king who's having to flee his throne, there have been times when God has shown incredible love to his people. Love to people that weren't always perfect. Maybe they were just in service to God. Maybe they were suffering for their own choices. And yet God in his grace brings up people next to his people to remind them that God is good and God is with them. This is a special ministry that we can have towards one another, that in our lowest moments, our friends can come up next to us and remind us of the steadfast love of God, and not just remind us of it, but then show it to us as they stay with us in those low moments. Have you known an Ittai? Have you known a Ruth? Have you known households like the household of Onesiphorus? People who in your low moments, whether you cause them or others cause them, in your low moments, they show you the grace and kindness and goodness of God. Do you have that opportunity today? Believers, this is how we show Christ. Not in glorious public ways all the time, but in genuine ways where we remind people, God is still with you. You're not alone. In the next conversation, then two men, Abiathar and Zadok, come up, and David talks specifically with Zadok. And it's not just these men are bringing with them the ark. And everyone passes out of the city, and then David, once again, verse 25, called the king, says to Zadok, okay, you can take the ark back now. See, thankfully, David recognizes that it's not the ark who will save that will save him. It's not the ark that will bring victory. And really, it's not the ark ultimately that determines whether God is with him or not. It's not the ark that determines whether he is in God's blessing or not. No, bring the ark of God back to the city. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back and let me see both it and his dwelling place. But David also knows that he faces consequences. And so, if God's work through him as king is over, then let God bring that about as well. You could go back to 1 Samuel to see more of the history of Israel here. 1 Samuel 4. There the elders make the mistake of thinking that by bringing the ark into the battlefield, they'll know victory. And they suffer. Israel suffers a terrible defeat. David does not make that mistake. He entrusts himself into the hands of God and sends the ark back into the city. But even as he does this, he makes sure that the son of Abiathar and the son of Zadok are available to carry messages. David has not given up yet. I want to read this quote from another commentator. Just thinking through the God who is sovereign in all things and the people of God who bear responsibility and yet should trust the God who is sovereign. Now watch how truly free faith is. There are some who say that if you really hold to God's sovereignty, or in other words, take wild positions like David just did, then you'll sit on your hands and do nothing. That is not true. To share such a Davidic faith in or grip on Yahweh's sovereignty does not stifle, but releases human resourcefulness and ingenuity. Notice verses 27 and 28. As soon as David plops himself wholly in God's hands, he nevertheless forms a fifth column within the city. Now I had to look up what fifth column means. Fifth column apparently is you're hiding an enemy in the territory. And so that fifth column is going to be Hushai, David's friend. This quote is bringing out, look, David entrusts himself to the sovereign God who is working in all of this. And David still stays busy as king. Trusting in God's sovereignty frees us to do what we can, knowing that God is over all things. We still bear responsibility, but we should carry out that responsibility ultimately with faith in the God who is always working. Very simply, after looking at the conversation with David and Zadok, Saint, where's your trust? Christian, where's your trust? And not only can we look at your words for evidence of that trust, but can we also look at your life for evidence of that trust? Verse 30, David then goes up the Mount of Olives, weeping as he goes. Here's the king fleeing the capital city, barefoot with his head covered, a sign of mourning. All the people who were with him covered their heads, and they went up weeping as they went. And we want to run to verse 31, because there we see David crying out for God to work once again. It's refreshing to see David praying once again. I want to go there, but before I stop there, I want to ask, is there any connection between verse 30 and verse 31? Is there any connection to David being humbled by this journey, being barefoot with his head covered, or in other words, mourning, crying, weeping as he leaves Jerusalem? Is there any connection to that experience of climbing up this mount outside of Jerusalem and being humiliated? Is there any connection there to him now praying? Of course, I would urge us to see that there is a connection. Is it perhaps the kindness of God to allow David to be humbled to this extent so that finally, in his humbled estate, David is willing to look to God and to cry out for God to work? because he hears this news as he's leaving Jerusalem. Ahithophel has turned. It's the Benedict Arnold. In other words, could it get any worse? I'm already leaving and now I'm being stabbed already. My trusted counselor is now helping my rebellious son. God is allowing David to suffer, but in that suffering now, God is helping David to turn his eyes back to himself. God teaches us even as we weep over the consequences of our own sin. And if God held back the consequences sometimes and kept us from having to weep, would we be so ready to seek him and to seek his help in the misery of life that we bring upon ourselves? So, saint, you might admit this morning, if it's true, that you are in a low point. And you might even admit that you can see how some of your choices and conversations brought you to that point. Maybe that's true. And maybe one thing that you're wrestling with is, why has God allowed my life to unravel so much? Is he not a God of grace? Is he not a God of mercy? And one response that this story provides to you is perhaps that misery that you're experiencing right now is itself evidence that God is a God of grace and mercy. Perhaps what you're experiencing now is itself what you need in order for your heart finally to break, and finally in humility for you to look up to God. It's not just in our youth that we need discipline. So I would urge us to see that David's prayer in verse 31 is actually the fruit of God's sovereign work in his life. Praise God that he does not give up, but instead continues to work in such a way that makes the heart of his servant supple once again. Then we come to verse 32, and David's talk with Hushai. I kind of like this part of the story because if you're telling a story, I mean, really is still going towards a sort of climax at this point. And you recognize David is having to leave. You're looking back at the concubines he's left behind going, I wonder if that's going to end well. He's guiding all these people. There's some encouragement along the way about who's staying with him. But then there is truly sorrow as they're climbing this hill. There's further bad news with Ahithophel turning to the other side. There's this glory of David humbling himself before the Lord. And then this man just stumbles onto the scene. His clothes are torn, dirt's on his head. Perhaps he even looks a little bit mad. It's Hushai, David's friend. And then you hear David speaking in verse 33, and is this not confusing at first? If you go on with me, you will be a burden to me. Like, David, hold on. Have you looked around? You need friends right now. This is a good thing. Moses uses this term to speak of how the nation is a burden to him. In Numbers chapter 11. I think here we see a little bit of the heart of the king. As he leaves, he knows it's due to his mistakes. Yes, Absalom is sinning. But how can he not feel responsibility for what's going on? As he's going, others are going with him. He doesn't know how it's going to end. Could this be their last journey as well? I don't believe that David is only feeling the burden of responsibility for Hushai. I think he's feeling that burden of responsibility for everybody who leaves Jerusalem with him. Husai, if you stay with me, I'm going to be burdened for your sake, for your safety as well. That's really, I think that makes more sense of it, because you look at it and he's sent back into the teeth of the lion at this point. How is that safer for Hushai? I don't think that David sees anybody as being safe right now. And so really that's the way of speaking to his friend to get his attention and say, I think I have something better in mind for you. Rather than me just caring for another person in retreat, let's do this. And he devises this plan. Hushai is willing. And so Hushai goes back towards Absalom's administration with the intent purpose of passing on information through the two men's sons. And ultimately, Hushai is going to try to throw off and counteract the advice of Ahithophel. What do you take from that conversation? Well, I take from the conversation with Ittai, let me just back up a little bit. Ittai, and those words of speaking of God to each other, I take that as God reminding David that he is still with him. Here's another one who will support. That's just the sovereign work of God to provide encouragers. The conversation with Zadok, here's David's opportunity to just place himself in God's hands right at the outset. Whatever happens, God is in control. The message about Ahithophel turning is perhaps the lowest of the low here. And David is just pleading with God, turn this around. And then as he makes that request, can we not see how God works to bring Hushai on the scene? God, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. Will God turn Ahithophel's counsel into foolishness? If you've read ahead, Ahithophel's counsel is right on. He continues to be a wise counselor. He's on the wrong side, but what he says will work. Nonetheless, God hears this prayer, and God is working, and that is evident by bringing Hushai on the scene right after we see this prayer. In other words, God hears the prayer of David and continues to work for him. And in Hushai is going to be the answer to Ahithophel's counsel. In Hushai is going to be the time that David needs to gather a force and defend his throne. And really what we see by the end of the chapter is that David is active once again. The king is being a king once again. He might not call himself the king at the moment, but he is still guiding people. He's still trying to protect people. He is still even blessing others in the name of God. He is still counting on God to work, recognizing that he cannot do everything. We see David being active once again. And so, yes, his house is suffering evil from within, but God is at work through his repentant servant. Putting it back towards us, can you look back in your life and see key moments when you're perhaps still battling some shame from those past choices that you made? Maybe that's the case still. Maybe there's still the question of, when I failed there, did that mean that the rest of my life now is useless? Or maybe you know enough theology to say, I shouldn't land there. But you still battle hopelessness at times. You still think that you're just this cast-off tool for the Lord. Maybe I'll have some moments here and there. I want you to see in 2 Samuel 15 the way that God engages in David's life. The thoroughness with which God is at work. Would it have been better if David had made different choices? Absolutely. But God does not depend upon our perfection. We do not throw off and forever ruin the plan of God by our sin. Don't use that to accept your sin. Use that to take comfort in the God who is above your sin. If God has saved you for good works, and you are alive today, then you have opportunity to serve God in those good works. Not only that, but he continues to be sovereign. He continues to show grace to you, his child. Is it possible that you still suffer from what you've done in the past? Absolutely. But don't look at that ongoing consequence and therefore determine, child of God, that he is against you. That would be a wrong conclusion. You would be giving in to deception at that point. See that both are here. Consequences, and the reality is we need consequences in order to change, but also grace. Are you recognizing the grace of God in your life? The grace of God might show up in that friend that you don't think enough of, but loves God and loves you. The grace of God might show up in just how he orchestrates different events in your life. The grace of God might show up in how he brings you yet lower still. But God continues to be at work in his people. Hope is not lost. And friend, if you don't know this God personally, failure will still come. You will still fail. You will still bring consequences to your life. But then at that point, you will have no true hope beyond humanity for anything different. If you are going to wreck your life, and all of us in some way wreck our lives, if you're going to do that without God, then the only answer that you have in response to the misery of life you bring upon yourself is something rooted in this world. Maybe your dependence is on your own brain. Maybe it's on the inheritance that was passed down to you. Maybe it's on the health which you treasure. Maybe it's on the government. Maybe your health is in, or your hope is in something I haven't mentioned. But ultimately, that will fail. And our hope, our prayer really, is that you would be able to come at some point to come and say with us, the Lord is my shepherd. You would at some point recognize the true God to be your God. You would at some point recognize that you need Christ. You need one who will rescue you from the misery you've brought on yourself and that others have brought to you. Our hope is that you are able to sing with us to this great God one day, knowing that we cannot fix our lives, but that he graciously continues to work in this world. So really, at the end of the day, if you don't know this God, your choice is either stay as one apart from that God and try to fix life yourself and ultimately be an enemy of that God, or turn to that God for salvation. And we can tell you in many different ways with many different stories that this God is gracious. He is merciful. We are not worthy of his love, but his love is astounding. We want to speak more to you of that in conversation. We want to point to Scripture and show you Christ because you need him. And we are not here because we have fixed our own lives. We are here by the grace of God, and to him be the glory. Our God, we thank you for the grace that you have shown, the kindness that you have shown to David. He was not worthy of it, and yet you showed it anyway. Please encourage your people this morning. We have made our lives worse, and we can still make our lives worse today. As we continually have opportunity to sin, have desire to sin against you. But the story is not ultimately about us. It is about you. the God who is perfectly just and wise and over all things, the God who has brought salvation to a rebellious people, not in that a specific nation, but a rebellious humanity. You have chosen to bring salvation. So please encourage your people this morning to see evidences of your sovereign grace in their lives even now, to recognize if you have brought discipline and it's for our good, if you have brought friends who speak words of truth from your word, it is your kindness. And if you've brought those low moments, you are still with us at those lowest valleys, because you, God, are the shepherd of your people. And we long for others to know your care, your love, your salvation as well, to stop their fighting against you and finally submit to you. And simply to do that by recognizing that they have sinned against you, the holy God, and are guilty. And they need Christ to rescue them from that place of being guilty sinners before you. They need Christ to bring them to be your children, forgiven and accepted. So if we have opportunity to talk to others here about you, help us be faithful and point them to you, the God who saves. As you give us opportunity this week, in people we know, down the street, people we know at work, people we know perhaps at the hospital, the doctor's office, people we know far away but whom we still talk to, as we have opportunity, may we speak of the God who graciously saves and rescues, not because we are worthy, but because you are great and you are good. We pray these things in Jesus' name.